University, the voice of Reitman University.
Welcome everyone to Startup Shook. Today we're joined with Thomas, which I found in the Business Today Conference in New York. How are you, Thomas?
I'm doing very well. How are you? I'm kind of just hanging out in Mexico City for a few weeks, trying to keep my head above water.
Thomas is the CTO of the Vanderbilt Fusion Project, and you could talk to us about that. And you're building something new, which is Alexandrian.
Yes. So the Vanderbilt Fusion Project is a really interesting group at Vanderbilt University, United States. So it started my freshman year when a couple of students in engineering at Vanderbilt were sitting together in a dorm. And you're surrounded by all these fantastic professors and resources and precocious students. And we all just felt like, what's something special we can do while we're here? You know, something more exciting than just padding our resume. And as a joke, someone made the comment, like, let's try to build a fusion reactor. And everyone kind of laughed it off. And then we looked into it and we found that there was a realistic architecture that we could implement called an IEC, or inertial electrostatic confinement, that we could get funding for about $100,000 or less and build this. And in the process, we built a unprecedented student organization at Vanderbilt, kind of like a nonprofit or volunteer club where students can learn about fusion engineering, entrepreneurship, tech, marketing, in the context of a seriously cool and exciting project. So that's coming on 3 years now. And in that time, we've won numerous grants and pitch competitions. We've been personally supported by the chancellor. We presented at national labs across the country, and we have built, assembled, and we're now licensing our own nuclear fusion reactor on campus.
What is the progress right now? Where are you guys?
Right now, we have a nuclear fusion reactor in a lab on campus, and we're working with Vanderbilt Environmental Health and Safety and the Tennessee Nuclear Energy Advisory Council to receive permission or licensing to turn it on. So it's more so a question of safety and lab space than engineering or design, which unfortunately is actually a great preparation for being an engineer or entrepreneur.
Gotcha. And Thomas, when I met you in the Business Today Conference, which by the way is a very cool conference for anyone listening to join next year, they connect students and great business leaders, tenured Fortune 500 company leaders from all across the world and primarily in the USA with students like us. And there I met Thomas, and amongst all the people there, you seem very, very peculiar because you're not like everyone else. And I'm not going to say this lightly, but there's not many people in my entire life which I can say this about, which is people who would sort of wake me up, that is possible. That kind of people exist. And you're one of them. The other one, you're the second one. The first one was a friend of mine named Jason. He is now running an AI company in UC Berkeley.
Wow.
I met him in sixth grade of elementary. And he was a great friend of mine. And the peculiar thing about him is that when I was growing up, I thought that being a great student is, you can't achieve anything else besides that. You just got to be either the jock or the nerd. And that was it. You have two choices. And growing up in a very immigrant Chinese household, I chose the first, which is to become an academic weapon and just be very strict with my grades. When he showed up, he was this outgoing, extroverted, and great basketball player. He played in the school, and he was ranked number one in school. I was like, all right. So that opened my eye. This thing is possible. And from then on, I thought, let me be that guy. Let me be a well-rounded person, not just one-sided. And time went on, and I think I sort of grew into that kind of person now with the things I'm running, and I'm quite proud of them. But then I met you in the Business Studio Conference, and I realized, okay, when I first saw you, you were in the Impact Challenge,
yes,
which I think you did great. You did amazing. You were so well-spoken. You spoke very well. You presented very well. Presentation aside, what you're talking about is actually very, very serious and amazing and quite in a different ballpark than what the other contestants are talking about. You know, they're talking about food recycling. They're talking about, there's another one, which is about the fentanyl.
Fentanyl strips, yeah.
That one was good as well. That one was good as well. But I think you should have been number one, purely because I'm also a physics nerd. I like Vsauce, you know, Veritas.
Yeah.
Kind of science in that field. So I thought you should be number one. But you presented very well. And when you sat back down, I thought, this guy, you know, I got to talk to this guy. And we grabbed drinks in the bar at Marriott. And you spoke a bit about yourself and your other things, which is weightlifting, you know, nothing. No biggie, just weightlifting. Team USA.
Yeah.
And, you know, going around Mexico, all around the world. And this guy, okay. This is my second, like, waking moment in my life. All right. And you're like a year younger than me. You're 22, I'm 23. So, gotcha. Wow. Okay. This guy exists. And that is just a very, very interesting experience. I don't have a lot in my life. And you're the second person to do that. So that's, you know, props to you.
Thank you. That's very kind. I think I'd like to meet Jason now.
Right. Yeah. He's a very cool person. He's in Berkeley. He's going to come back to Indonesia soon. He built self-driving cars and he's now trying to revolutionize the AI industry in Indonesia, which is very, very kind of left behind compared to the US, obviously.
So, okay. Yeah.
That's him.
I wonder how much of that has to do with available compute resources.
Yeah. So you should probably talk to him. I'll definitely connect you guys.
Okay.
Alexandrian is definitely about that and can talk about that later. Before we go to Alexandrian though, I wanna get to know you more as a person. You seem very mysterious. You portray this image of a entrepreneur, you know, weightlifting, you kinda have everything like sorted out. And when we were in the conference, you just stuck out right there. You know, this guy's like very different than you don't hang out around the rest of the people.
It's because I don't want to be an investment banker. Why?
That's a good reason. Mm-hmm. I was also quite kind of left behind there because I'm doing a chemical engineering.
Exactly.
Quite 50 economics students. But tell us a bit about your childhood. What was you growing up like?
Yeah.
What was your interest growing up? What did you do? Where did you grow up?
So I was born in upstate New York as the sixth kid and the only son after five daughters. When I was born and living in New York, where I attended elementary school, my family lived in affluence. But when I was in middle school, my father was terminated and we moved to the South, which was a very different environment. We went to Florida and I continued in public schools, but I was surrounded by immense amounts of violence, of drug abuse, of gang affiliations, and I started getting a lot of trouble. So my folks used to send me off to South Dakota in the summers, where my father's family lived and some of my relatives ranched and farmed and hunted. So I'd go there for the summers, come back for the spring and academic year. And in high school, I wasn't exactly a nerd. I wasn't that concerned with grades. I was an athlete. I started competing in competitive weightlifting because I was playing football and wrestling. So they sort of made me do it and I excelled. And by the time I had graduated high school, I had won numerous state championships, some national medals. I'd been awarded some scholarships. But unfortunately, weightlifting in the United States, collegiate circle doesn't have the same resources that cross country or wrestling or track do. So I declined those scholarships and chose to instead enroll at Vanderbilt, where I continued to train, compete independent without any university support until very recently. But as a kid growing up, I was probably like most very, very precocious, very peculiar and eccentric. And then by the time I'd entered high school, though, I had just had this experience of so very often being an outsider in most rooms. I mean, I'd lived in the North and the South. I had been in very wealthy circles and then the opposite. I had been around violence. I'd been around farmers. And I think it just made me become very interested in how your lived experience affects how you think. In high school in particular, I fell very much in love with philosophy, with the works, of course, of Jacques Derrida, Michel Foucault, Jean Baudrillard, the epistemologists, so Keith Layer, Gettier, all these people. And like you, I did have a passion for math and physics, but there wasn't always the same accessibility to it. I mean, I could go watch YouTube videos or play around with a notebook, but, you know, no one's going to let me work in their lab when I'm 15 or 16. But I could always go to the library and get something off the shelf. And I had a few mentors in high school, too, and my teachers in the IV program who, like me, loved literature and philosophy. So they were kind of like soundboards that I could talk to, that I could get mentorship by, who would let me read in their office during lunch instead of doing whatever else I was going to do. Yeah.
I'd love to dive deep into topics of philosophy. What were your top questions in philosophy that you would like to ponder about?
That's a fantastic question. So in philosophy, I'm particularly interested in an area that might be called the continental tradition. So in the 20th century in Europe, the field of philosophy kind of moves in two different directions. Around Germany and England, you might see what's called the analytic tradition. They're very concerned with language, with logic, with how math works. Can we deduce knowledge? Can we prove what the limits of computation are? And they're going to be the ones who are developing formal logic, predicate logic, Boolean algebra, some of the things we see in computers today. On the other hand, you have the continental tradition, which is called continental because it's coming mostly out of France, Germany, Italy, the Ashkenazi people, so people on the continent of Europe. And they're going to be asking these more synthetic, complex questions. So, for instance, there was a school of philosophers called the Frankfurt School, who primarily emigrated from Germany to Columbia University following the Holocaust. And there was this massive moment in philosophy where it was essentially like, okay, that just happened. That's one of the weirdest, most terrible things in human history. How did people do that? And they're going to be asking, like, what economic factors, what political factors, what aspects of psychology and religion laid the foundation to cause people to think that way. Meaning they aren't just going to say, okay, we have a philosophical question. Let's look at the library under philosophy. Let's look at every genre. Let's look at all these different studies. Let's synthesize them together. So within that context, I'm particularly interested in what might be considered the French modern and postmodern tradition. And my favorite thinker is probably Jean Baudrillard. Now, he's most famous for a series of essays called Simulacra and Simulation. And he is particularly concerned with how we derive meaning from reality and how this relationship between the real world and our meaningful understanding can change, how things can be duplicated, simulated, replaced, obscured, and so on. So he's going to be very, very concerned with the role of media in the late 20th century. He wrote a series of essays on the Gulf War called The Gulf War Will Not Take Place, The Gulf War Is Not Taking Place, and The Gulf War Did Not Take Place. And his whole argument was that it had moved so much away from what we might consider a war in historic sense, you know, that truly violent action, that decimation of peoples, into so much of a political, geopolitical orchestration. He made a very ironic joke that, you know, political officials nowadays will commandeer a war sitting oceans away in what is ironically called a war room, not on the ground in that moment of experience of history of violence or anything. So with that, I'm always very, very fascinated, especially in, you know, the 21st century, where we're very much concerned with what we might call abstract ideas related to gender, faith, experience, truth, value, wealth, how these underlying notions have been distorted or appropriated throughout recent history.
So if I may summarize the question you're trying to solve into one sentence that the common man can understand. It is to gather all possible questions that would lead to a certain action any person would like to take, like the Holocaust you took as an example. What factors that we can take, everything, economic, social, political, and gather them into a summary on why that happened?
In a certain sense, I mean, to go back to what I was just saying about Baudrillard, think about, you know, the underlying mechanism of the Holocaust is trying to decide what is and isn't human, or who isn't and isn't eligible for human rights. So something as inherent, as natural, as understandable as looking at a person and identifying them as you know, human, as having value, can be distorted by ulterior mechanisms such as, you know, the economic history of Germany in the early 20th century, of, you know, the Protestant depiction of Judaism and the Zionist movement at that same time. There are all these non-physical social and cultural movements going on that can almost short circuit and get in the way of real experience. Mm-hmm. And when I say that I'm very, very curious in that perspective, it is not even necessarily in the context of the Holocaust or European history, just more so that idea of what are the lines between what we think and what we experience, and how do things get in the way and interrupt them.
Very interesting. You mentioned something before which I really agree on, your lived experience and how it impacts your beliefs, your personality, and how you carry yourself. Tell us a bit about the influence of your early childhood in affluence and being moved into an environment opposite of that. What was the few things you noticed changed in your character?
Yeah. So I think one thing that's made me unique throughout most of my academic and professional success has been I've always felt like no matter what you do, what ventures or what context of your work, you will be the common denominator. Whether you're doing a venture in deep tech or you're a professor or an employee or just a mother or father, you're the only constant denominator between all those situations. And for that reason, I've very often been more concerned with putting myself in situations that will challenge my humility, challenge my ability to connect with others, and challenge my backbone than necessarily, you know, add a credential, get a grade, get a paycheck. Probably to a fault, I mean, but I think much of that came out of the experience of that placelessness of always moving around, always being around different people, of being the city slicker when I'm in South Dakota with my family, but then I'm the redneck cowboy when I'm in the South with everyone else.
Mm-hmm. What was the lessons you, how does it impact your ambition? Because I'm guessing being raised during your childhood in affluence sort of given you an image of where you should be in life, or where the direction you should be going, and then being removed from there sort of gave you that drive to get it all back. Do you relate to that?
No, I don't think so. I think actually the opposite. I think what more so left with me was an impression that things change, things go away, and that's fine. There is so much goodness and security beyond whatever arrogant or avaricious ends we want to pursue. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, I think it just very much left in me this sense of caring more about trying to be as genuine, as generous, as humble, and as patient as I can be, which are all four adjectives that I'm sure there's a long list of people who would never associate those words with me. So I apologize to them, but like, this is kind of my experience. You know, this realization that so much of your life has changed, but there's still so much goodness there. You're fine. So what is the sense of loss being felt towards, you know?
That's wonderful. Going back to the philosophical topics you mentioned, which is trying to understand a lot of non-physical forces that affect how society functions, how does that relate to, or does it relate at all to your next venture, Alexandrian, where you try to understand big data and how to, you know, utilize them and make useful decisions out of them?
It has a fantastic impact on that. See, one thing that I think very often about in philosophy and technology is, what do we mean when we say progress? I mean, the iPhone is one of the most influential and fantastic inventions of the last 20 years. Has it made us happier? Has it made us safer? Has it made us better? You know, could we accurately say that it put us towards progress? Because progress doesn't mean advancing for its own sake. Progress means approaching a final end. And that's not to say that it hasn't. I mean, if I worked for Apple and invented the iPhone, then that institution allowed me to have organizational healthcare, which enabled me to potentially raise children. It gave me a salary. It let me have some sense of satisfaction and actualization for my work. So my point being that the concept of progress in technology is a very, very controversial, or rather controverted, question. So when I think about things like artificial intelligence or blockchain or iPhones or traffic lights or small modular reactors, there's this big question, and it is, okay, does it just kick the can forward, or does it actually make a substantive difference? Because there's this big irony that I always think about in terms of enterprise engineering, and it's like, if you produce a technology that is twice as efficient, your organization will not cut back its use in half. It'll just double how much it's doing for the same price. Sure. And that's kind of the reality of a lot of engineered technologies, which is complicated because it puts such a terrible shadow on so much of the sustainable work engineers and innovators try to produce. And my point is, how can we identify specific technologies or paradigms that can adequately be considered progress? And I like to think a lot about the idea of, like, what does sustainable mean? Like, what does it mean to be natural? So if you remember from my speech at the Impact Challenge, the first thing I shared was that fusion is how the sun works. It is what has warmed our crops and blessed our skin for millennia. There is a natural paradigm for that technology. And there is a very realistic reason for us to want to recreate it on Earth, as opposed to, you know, fission or heavy uranium-based fission, which is just such a powerful technology, but so, so dangerous and unsustainable. Mm-hmm. And just as much with artificial intelligence, you've so very much heard the phrase neural network or neural engineering. And if you were to ask me, as someone who studies computers and philosophy, I'd say to you that the brain is the most powerful, fascinating computer that we personally get to experience. I mean, its ability to rapidly parallelize tasks, to chunk information. I mean, the amount of computation required to process images and sounds is fantastic. The fact that the brain can do it so naturally truly is novel. So for that reason, I also become very interested in this idea that neuromorphic engineering or neural chip design can also be a true use of the word progress. And just as much, I'm still pondering the third a little bit more, but most of my work is actually in quantum computing. And some would say quantum mechanics is what describes nature. I'm a little bit more skeptical of that claim, but I am also curious if there's a similar way where, you know, quantum engineering and quantum information science can invoke some valid use of the word progress. So to put it all together about my work with Alexandrian is, what I want to do with Alexandrian is increase the scope of parallelizable tasks for networks. So when I say parallel computing, what I mean is the ability to take a large algorithm or computation and run it on hardware systems in tandem, so they all work at the same time and then can allocate back. I said earlier that your brain is like a massively parallelizable computer because that's what it does. It runs a lot of things at once simultaneously and then aggregates the answers. CPUs might be considered a sequential processor. It goes step one, step two, step three. GPUs are somewhat comparable.
Do we actually run everything in parallel? Don't we stop processes and do another thing and then stop it? And then we switch tasks a lot, but we don't actually do everything in parallel. This is why they would say, people don't actually multitask. You just switch tasks very quickly.
Well, we're getting into semantics a little bit, because if everything was going on in parallel and every aspect of your brain was firing at once, I mean, you'd be pissing yourself while speaking. You'd be flailing your arms in the air. There'd be so much going on. And you're right, where multitasking is a specific allocation of random access memory. My point is, there are still so many processes in the brain that are sent in parallel and allocated. So, like, we can think of a specific example where if I were to ask you to find the cube of 8, where you'd be stopping and firing with your random access memory in a specific cortex to perform that computation. But in the much larger, grander scheme of thinking, I mean, even this conversation where I just thought of some arithmetic operation, meanwhile, my brain is loading language, it is producing you know, muscular contractions in my mouth. There is so much parallelization in the brain's function. And that's also to add, to be compounded by what we might call neural connectivity, which is the ability of neurons to talk to other neurons. With, you know, quantum computers and classical computers, the connectivity of bits and qubits is severely limited compared to neurons, which is another reason why it's so efficient. I mean, imagine you had a line of 100 people and they just had to go one down the line left to right to talk. Now imagine how much easier it is if you just have them stand like in a clump and they can just talk to six other people at once. That's effectively the comparison. Yeah. But my point with Alexandrian was I want to increase the scope of parallelizable tasks for what we might call a heterogeneous network. Mm-hmm. So at the network level, say we have a warehouse scale data center or supercomputer or a wireless service that has a bunch of nodes of CPUs and GPUs. Maybe it has a quantum computer, a quantum annealer. Maybe there are some NPUs, neural processing units on a specific node. And this is localized in a, say, like a small geographic region, say like the American Northeast. Is I want to produce a technology that can efficiently route computations to the most hardware appropriate node or system at a sufficient scale and with enough security to increase efficiency and help integrate these novel computing paradigms like quantum and neural in the near term. So for me, it becomes a very philosophical question where it is like, what is it about this hardware system and quite literally how it processes information, how its registers and processors are arranged to compute tasks that makes it advantageous for this abstracted algorithm? You know, like, why is it that GPUs are favorable for training AI models? I mean, the answer is it has to do very literally with the actual arrangement of bits and digital systems on the chip. Mm-hmm. And likewise, that's why CPUs are advantageous for general executive functions like task scheduling. And likewise, why quantum systems are useful for unbounded optimization problems, for inherently stochastic questions. And again, neural processors for things that require chunking or the processing of images or audio signals.
While a part of my brain wants to ask deeper on how would you approach solving this, and I've seen your presentation in Paris that you wanted to build an MVP through software primarily and then hardware. Another part of my mind, in parallel, was the second question that you proposed, which I find was very, very interesting, which is, how do you define progress? That was a very good question. It led me thinking, is that really how humans approach doing things? Do we think about that would be better and let's call that progress and let's work towards it? Or do we just do what we do because we can, which what I theorize we might be actually doing? Because if you think about it, every single cell in your body, all they ever want to do is just to reproduce and keep living. And that's it. Life is like a recursive function that doesn't really have a purpose. It just keeps happening and it just keeps going with no apparent direction. That going up the level of abstraction to us, human society, what that translates to is people having hopes, dreams. Ah, I want to do this for tomorrow. I want to build air ventilation so that we can live better. But really, all that does is to remove us further and further away from death so that life, main function, could keep running. Because of that, your question, how do we define progress, sort of questions the direction of where are we going as a society in general. Do we know where we're going and we can envision where we want life to be and we build that? We think we do because we've envisioned certain futuristic technologies that we would like to have, and therefore we create them. But don't you think we just do it because we can and we don't really know where we're going? We just stumble upon an invention and we kept going at it, and since it's quite useful, we kept it around and it just stuck with us. And that's like the iPhone. We don't really thought about where it could lead to. We have a certain range of time span in our heads on where technology can lead. As long as it keeps us living and it doesn't just kill a bunch of people at once, I think that would be a simple decision maker on whether or not we should keep certain technologies. And sure, it's not ideal. The iPhone, a lot of technology, social media is not in the macroscopic very good. But I guess in the long run, it keeps life going. And sure, it will create inequalities in society. It will create certain generations, which are just, you know, the Gen Z term we call it brain rot, sort of like a second generation battery to this whole matrix that society, and to fund billion-dollar companies so that they can keep running. Just give us your thoughts on how do we approach answering that question on whether or not something is actually good for progress.
Well, A useful method to learn about philosophy when you're encountering complex questions like this is to try to break it down into agents and ends. So within your example, we were distinguishing between two different groups, individuals and then what we might call the social scale. So obviously, if you're an individual and you're getting hired by a certain company to engineer a product and you're using that to support your livelihood, to advance your career, to feed yourself, I think we can reasonably say that that's, you know, some form of progress within your own life. But if you're a social scale, if you're an entire government trying to allocate, you know, $12 billion for research or for DARPA, then the conversation changes a lot. And another distinction we can make is what we've kind of been disagreeing with here. And it's the idea of, is progress just an immediate in the moment, this is better, a very present focused judgment? Or is it something that involves what in philosophy we might call a sense of telos, a sense of final cause? Now, again, we can all investigate our own lives and consider which one we might lean to, but there's a very famous idea in philosophy called a dialectic. Now, very broadly, a dialectic just means a disagreement or a contradiction. So if you've ever heard of the Platonic method of teaching, or if you've read a Platonic dialogue, that is when, you know, Socrates is saying, what does it mean to be a triangle? And some student gives an answer and he's like, well, then why does this work? And it's just going back and forth until you arrive at solution. But that's kind of the low definition. In a greater level, what you might see as, I guess you could say kind of the Hegelian or the definition from Friedrich Engels is a dialectic is a relation between two ideas or concepts that satisfies three ends or three factors. First, the two ideas are what you might call interpenetrated opposites, meaning you need them to exist together to be able to understand the other one. So you can't have a sense of hot without a sense of cold. They very clearly need each other. Second, you might have what's called the transformation from quantity into quality. So going back with the temperature metaphor, I mean, like, how many degrees is it for something to be hot? That's kind of a ridiculous question. We don't have a specific answer, or, and if we do, it's kind of tongue in cheek. We know that as we progressively increase in a quantity of something, there's this transcendent quality that emerges. And the third, it might be called the process of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, meaning it is this idea, like I just mentioned earlier, where it's, you can have a statement, a thesis, like you're trying to turn your shower on and it's hot, but it's too hot. So now you have to negate it, your antithesis. So you turn it cold, and then it's too cold. So you have to synthesize those two prior events to make it just right. I'm trying to think of an example out of history, but if you ever hear from Hegel, the phrase dialectical historicism, that's what he's referring to. It is the process of reading historical movements in this context of thesis, antithesis, synthesis. And that's kind of comparable too to what you might hear about Marx and dialectical materialism, which is very similar, but in the context of economic classes. I feel like all the examples I have of dialectical historicism are a little controversial, so I'm not sure if I want to share them, but...
We could cut some parts out if we decide that it's not appropriate.
Okay. Yeah, I think I can maybe give a soft version of one, but for instance, consider the persecution of Jews in Europe in the early 20th century. We might call that a thesis, a historical event that sets a statement. In response, the UN established the Jewish state of Israel, an antithesis. So instead of Jewish peoples being outsized by their nation, they now have their own nation. In recent years, there's been tremendous controversy going on in the West Bank about the relationship between Israel and Palestine. So what we are now seeing is a synthesis, wherein a group of people that were outed for being persecuted in their home have a new home, and now there's a controversy about ethnic violence in the region. Or more so on the social side, many might feel that in the early to mid 20th century, there was a hegemony for homosexuality, for, you know, your cis white straightness. In the 1970s and 80s, we see a very strong homosexual movement emerging. I mean, in the context of the AIDS epidemic, art, society, all of it, it's almost like a negation of the status quo. And always things change, things go out of style. And recently, in the last 20 years, we've seen a similar synthesis in the idea of bisexuality as an emerging identity. In fact, in the 90s, it was considered much more taboo than we might consider it today. And that's in the context of the last 60 years of back and forth between hetero and homosexuality, wherein they are now synthesized within another identity, which is not to discount anyone's experiences or say that it's that simple. Philosophy is like scientific theories. Like, you can't say they're true. You can't point to it like a law. It's a model for understanding that is useful in some situations, but has its limits. So going back to what we were talking about before, mm-hmm. about the idea of what is personal versus social progress, you see all those characteristics about dialectics. Like, okay, what is social progress? It's the sum of people. What is individual progress? It is the reduction of social progress. There are those interpenetrated opposite ideas that need each other for reference. How many good deeds do you need for something to count as progress, or to count as advancement or improvement? You know, when was it King Darius in the Persian Empire was outlawing slavery? How many individual events of generosity and tolerance does it take before we have some vast historical development? So we also see this sense of the quantity transforming into quality. And then, of course, I mean, we can find so many examples of that dialectic historical movement of progress and of technology. I mean, on the one hand, you have a massive breakthrough like the iPhone. That's a thesis, progress, fantastic technology. You have this negation where it is, you know, accusations of sweatshop labor, of brain rot, of whatever. And then it's synthesized into a new apogee of the two. And that's just kind of my point is it can be so difficult to try to sort between who we're talking about when we want to say the word progress and what qualifies for it. And part of that is just fundamental to how these ideas interact with each other.
How would you define progress?
I think it's very important for society to view progress in the context of some greater end or goal they're pursuing. For instance, sustainable energy is a fantastic end for us to judge progress towards. Ethical treatment of work is another fantastic end, which are all senses of just sustainable, healthy life. You know, they're a phenomenon that we could very much also describe a, you know, Kazakh village 3,000 years ago of possessing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That being said, going back to Alexandria, how was your solving? Mm-hmm. What's your plan on quick? And be as simple as possible with your words. Mm-hmm. And explain it to me like I'm a 5-year-old. How would you solve this problem?
So do you mean the problem of, you know, you could say isolated processes? Well, essentially, stop looking at the system at the node or board level. So if you ever visit a supercomputer, they have these things called partitions and nodes. And if you're a researcher and you're submitting a task, you might be given one node to run it on. It might be doing mostly GPU work and your CPUs are sitting doing nothing. So the first thing is to stop just viewing it in this isolated perspective and stop viewing computation as this rote, sequential, you know, mundane activity and start viewing it much more in the philosophical strategy and the philosophical sense of there is a question. What are its parameters? How can it be solved? I kind of want to unmoor people's perspective of computing as just some thing that's going on in your laptop or something on a CPU as a massive system of networks, of annealers, of data centers, of your own work, of online users, and to start viewing it in the much more fluid and I guess you could say unique way that we view social phenomena. So that's part of it. I guess that's more so the intellectual backdrop. And the first thing is there are different types of algorithms, to be more technical. There are searching algorithms that search a database. There are arithmetic operations. There are probabilistic ones like random number generators. Start looking at big compute tasks in the context of these sub-portions. Break down the massive question into this subtype that is more favorable to one system or another. Send it to that system and then send it back. And continuously iterate this process so you can optimize it. You can start getting this massive enterprise speed up, energy efficiency, and integrate these novel computing paradigms in the near term.
What is your MVP?
Our MVP would be an open source research tool for task scheduling on heterogeneous networks.
Open source?
Yeah. So if you're familiar with Slurm or CUDA or PBS, those are tools that researchers use to schedule tasks on distributed systems on a supercomputer. So you might have a big simulation, like a particle moving in a fluid. You might have written it all in Fortran or C with like a little bit of Python. You will write what's called a run script in PBS or Slurm or CUDA, basically telling the node or the partition in the supercomputer, okay, like do this, give it this much memory, give it this much RAM. If this happens, send this here. And those systems are fantastic. But again, they only distribute tasks based on available resources and they only do it at a node or partition level. And typically what you might call a homogeneous system. So like CPUs and GPUs. So my goal would be to produce kind of like a step up of it, a open source programming tool that can help you schedule tasks across heterogeneous networks.
And who would the clients, your first clients be?
Be researchers, easily. Researchers, scientists, anyone who has servers and big computers in their institution.
But would it be a downloadable software that anyone can install, or would it be something integrated in hardware that you would need to actually work with the hardware providers and let them become the clients?
Well, I can go in one of two directions. One, it will have to include some open source software tool. The same way that I can just download Linux and use it to run on different networks. There is a question related to the actual fiber optic engineering and communication between data centers and networks, which is more of a hardware question. And I'm not the only individual investigating this work. NVIDIA has been doing a lot of research recently in what you might call QCHPC, so connecting quantum computers to high-performance computing systems. And a lot of it is a question of, you know, if I have a bit of information here on this node and I have a computation running here, how do I get them to talk to each other? There's also a Finnish investment holding company, I want to say called VMM, that has been also doing really exciting work in that area. So there is a small part of it that also does have to do with just general network engineering and computer technology, but that is in addition to, not in replacement to, the open software sense of actually writing parallel code.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What is your face right now with Alexandrian? And relate that to where you are right now in Fusion. What was your plan with Fusion? You've spoken about this with me, but let the audience know as well.
So right now my phase with Alexandrian is dipping my toe in the waters for angel and pre-seed investments, but my goal is to enter an American PhD program to begin building and testing the technology. I'm currently working with the Vanderbilt Center for Tech Transfer and Commercialization to receive a patent for it, for the system architecture. But my goal is to spend the next 5 years in a lab with a team where I can be very concerned about the scientific merit of the technology and not any fiduciary responsibility. Yeah. And in relation to Fusion, because I will be graduating and moving on to computing, I will be leaving the organization soon. And we are currently preparing our next class of leaders to start the next phase of the organization.
Amazing. Having said all these very technical things and philosophy, I want to talk about the other side of you, which is weightlifting. How did you get into it? Okay, you've spoken about it in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they have. But tell me about your love of weightlifting, your competitions. What's your PRs? How much do you bench? Tell us about it.
Yeah, so I was always an athlete growing up. I mostly played football. And when I entered high school...
American football, soccer, which one is it?
Yes, American football. When I entered high school, I had been playing football my whole life. I was in this pretty rough school in Florida, and our team sucked. Like, our team was not good. We had good players, but we could not win games. And I was just so tired of what I call the peacocking, or the cockfighting that you see, where you have these individuals getting in fights in the locker rooms, you know, selling drugs out of their lockers, jawing with refs, cussing people out. And the thing is, like, football is a violent sport. You can do most of that. You just have to do it in between the whistles. So I was just very sick of being in this environment where it felt like there's just such a bravado and machismo all around, but no real, you know, work, skill, dedication. And that's generally a thing that just characterizes any bad athletic program over any good one. But because I was playing football and because I was wrestling, I just was naturally took to weightlifting. I was told to join the team.
What kind of wrestling did you do?
So we might call it folk style, which is typically what you see in American high schools and universities. But I was also much better at freestyle wrestling, if anyone listening is familiar with the sport. But I joined the weightlifting team, and I really enjoyed how individual it was, because it just meant that my success was a measure of my own dedication and my own effort. And I really stood out as a freshman, and my weightlifting coach urged me to give up the other two sports and just commit to weightlifting. And I took his advice, and I did that. And I think within a year, I was competing nationally. I was competing at the youth national championships. I was winning medals. I think I won my first national medal maybe a year and a half out from that. And by the time I had left high school, I had won numerous state championships, national medals. I was awarded scholarships. I did decide for fun to play football my senior year, and that was a blast. But weightlifting was my actual priority. And I had a few nicknames in the state too. Because of my skill in weightlifting, some people joked and would call me the Olympian, which was way too generous because I will never be good enough to go to the Olympics. But I also, when I was competing at that level in high school, it's a tradition in the United States to bleach your hair when you go to like the big competition. So because I'm so pale, people always call me the Russian too. Russia has a fantastic Olympic weightlifting team. Regardless, I declined my scholarships to pursue my academics at Vanderbilt, but I continued to train and compete independent of the school. So I would go to my classes in the mornings, I would eat and rest, and then I would get into the weight room at 3 o'clock. I used to walk a few blocks or maybe like about a half a mile or so to some gym that would, you know, let me in and just let me kind of do my thing. And I would just train probably until the evening. I'd rush to the dining hall before they close. I'd put on a Vanderbilt Nike tank top. So all the lunch ladies just assumed I was on the football team and they would give me some extra food. And that was what I did. And my freshman year, I won bronze at the university national championships. My sophomore year, I was named an All-American. I was named an All-American my junior year as well. This past summer, I won the under 23 national championship. And today's the 17th. Just last weekend, I finished sixth on the senior national stage at the American Open. Mm-hmm. So for the last 3 years, I've been chasing a Team USA selection. I've been very close to make the university team on a few occasions, and it looks like things are going to start coming together in the near future.
Way to go, man.
In terms of my PRs, I lift in the 81 kilo class. My best snatch is looking at about 130 kilos, and my best clean and jerk is looking at about 160, 65. I don't bench, but when I was in Florida in high school, I did, and the most I benched was, I want to say, either 300 or 315 when I was weighing about 160 pounds. It was somewhere between that.
Mm-hmm. Voila. Amazing. Man, you are for sure a polymath. Genius. No question about it. You have all these things going on. Do you know your IQ level?
Sorry?
Do you know your IQ level?
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sure it's between zero and some number.
Between zero and some number.
Mm-hmm.
Forget that. How have physical activities been influential in other parts of your life?
Well, I think it's been such a fantastic privilege. My work with Fusion Alexandrian recently has also been very trying, but I feel like so much of my success just throughout my life has been because of athletics. And not even for silly reasons. It's just, you get the opportunity to learn so much when you know what it takes to be at a high level of something. Mm-hmm. And you know, there are those athletes out there who've just won everything their whole life. Unfortunately, I was not that athlete. I have a terrible, my friends used to joke I was an eternal second place because I always went silver at events. And I should have gotten gold. There's a quote from Mike Tyson, though, where he says, like, I failed more than anyone else I've ever met, and that's why I'm so successful. And there's so much to be said about athletics and learning how to fail, how to be humiliated and embarrassed, how to be in pain and still keep going.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so much of my success in weightlifting has been more so a measure of my determination and my grit than actual skill, because I've been balancing it with my entrepreneurship and academics for the last 4 years. It takes a lot to be willing to say I'd rather fail than give up. You know, if I'm going to be in pain, it's fine. I'll be in pain for the next 6 hours. And then 6 hours later, I can decide if I'm a coward or if I have some backbone. And there's also just such a personal aspect about the experience of having to get up on a stage and do something hard that you might fail at. Take a lift that you might miss in front of, you know, on a national broadcast with people that have been watching you for years, train, compete. You put months into this specific competition, and yeah.
For my last question, genius sort of appreciate solitude. We have Nikola Tesla working alone in his lab, mm-hmm. And many other great brains like him. You are, for sure, quite a solitary person.
Appreciate, I am.
You appreciate the peace. How did you balance the vast amount of opportunities that is apparent in socially crowded environments compared to just doing something alone? You switched from the football team, or you left it for weightlifting, which you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
You really appreciate the fact that you can put your input and it will grant you the output that is correlated just to you. And you're fully responsible. You have 100% equity in your efforts.
Mm-hmm.
How do you balance knowing that doing things alone can get you quite fast ahead, although how should you measure how far you're going to go if you're doing things solitary?
Oh, that's a very complex question. I mean, I train alone because I left my team to go to Vanderbilt, and it's hard. It can be very difficult training alone. There is so much privilege in being around other people and being energized by them, supporting them, and vice versa. So I don't want to promote some image of like the, you know, lonely intellectual or anything. And even then, although I do very much love being alone, I have a great affection for what you might call being alone in public. For doing things on your own, but still meeting people. So I have a great affection for going to cafes and bars and making small talk with the bartender, with the barista, with learning about someone else, with being able to like walk into a room and you don't owe anyone their conversation. You can just be completely open to whoever new you might meet. And I do think that's an excellent skill. I think there's no greater thing in my life that I'd be proud to be than to be someone who can sit across from a table with anyone and have a pleasant, genuine conversation. And that is so much what inspires my interest in history and geography and culture, is so that I don't have to get in the situation where someone from Kyrgyzstan says hi, and I'm like, oh, that's cool. Where on a map is that? But I do very often worry sometimes when I spend too much time with others. And the reason why is you are so heavily influenced by the people around you. And there can be fantastic advantages in that, in being around ambitious, supportive people. But sometimes bad things happen too. Like, I've had the experience at times where I may be sitting at a place for breakfast and I hear a group of friends, you know, gossiping about someone else in their group. And that's the sort of conversation that happens when, you know, you have to fill the silence and you aren't thinking anymore about what you actually want to use your ability to speak for. And I've definitely sensed myself doing similar things at times in groups where maybe I'm traveling with some of my friends or colleagues and it's like, I start talking too much. I start saying things that I didn't think as much before. Mm-hmm. I don't even mean necessarily like crude or auspicious things, but just sometimes, I don't know, I don't like that. I don't want to be that way. Mm-hmm. And I noticed this so very much at that conference in New York, because there are so many students who enter undergraduate and they obviously wrote their college essay about something they wanted to do or something that seemed interesting. And then they get put in such a different socially isolated environment. And when I say socially isolated, what I mean is when you're a college student in the traditional four-year program, you are probably 85% of your social experience is with other, you know, 18-year-old students in your dorm and in your classes. Sure. There's not the same variety of experience of, you know, I go to this bar and the bartender has two kids and is 42 and she's talking to me about her family's Christmas plans, or, you know, I'm going back home and I'm helping my dad do yard work. There's not that variety of social presence outside of you. So it's so easy for, like, I'm going to say toxic ideas to just become virulent in that setting. I mean, I don't want to sound skeptical of career paths like investment banking, consulting, hedge funds, any of those things, because they play such a fantastic role in our economy and in the funding of fantastic technologies and experiences. But I wonder how many students more so felt a external social pressure to view those things as success and as esteem and prestige and as class, and then appropriated themselves into it. Mm-hmm. You know, like if you're sitting in dorms with 400 people and 300 of them are saying that this was what goodness looks like and this is what success is, and look at who just emailed me back. Like, it's very, very easy to start judging yourself that way. And that's the most tragic thing, is just that it's so easy for us to become subject to our own insecurities. And it's very, very hard to stand up to it. I mean, I feel like that's something I've struggled with immensely as well.
Very, very good answers. What is your ambition? What is your drive? Where do you want to be in life in, say, 5-10 years? What is your purpose?
Yeah. So you asked me a few questions there. You asked me what drives me. And I feel like I'm very often driven by two things. And the first is just a general curiosity. I mean, like I said earlier about how I feel like you're the common denominator in everything you ever do. So it's worth having diverse experiences and trying to be a pretty good person, or at least a pretty thoughtful one. So that sense of curiosity is so often what motivates me to go to some random conference in New York, or fly to Mexico City, or take a drive to this place, walk into this bar, have a shot with that guy. Just that complexity of lived experience that I think is just so fascinating and lets you learn so much. I mean, I always joke that the bad thing about textbooks is you know what you're going to learn from them. You should try to pursue experiences where you have no idea what it is you might learn. Mm. So, and of course, everyone has different values. So I don't want to speak for others and say they should do that. But like, say, for instance, you're choosing between going to a graduate program in Boston and in Zurich. You know, I'm American. I'd probably be pretty comfortable in Boston. But how many unique things would I learn being in Zurich? How many things that I wouldn't even expect? The little idiosyncrasies about how a different culture walks into a cafe, how they sit down, how they order, you know, their experiences with the role of sports in secondary school education, how it affects their, you know, hiring processes, all these random things that we don't even think about. And that's kind of what drives me. That's why I want to skip a class and go somewhere else, or skip a class and read something I don't know anything about. And then you ask me what I want to achieve, or what I am convicted towards. And I think the biggest thing that I realized is it would just feel so privileged and fortunate for the opportunities I've had and the skills I've been given. You've made the comment that you think I'm a pretty smart guy. And the thing is, like, that's a privilege. There are lots of people who aren't. And I don't want to sound like facetious or anything. I just mean, like, I am so lucky that school is something that I could take interest in and excel at. Because there are so many people who think that's what goodness looks like, who thinks that's what you're supposed to do. And if you tell them that you study quantum physics at Vanderbilt, they think like you're the one doing it right. When in reality, that's ridiculous. Like, there are so many different things that matter to people and that are good. And I hate when people feel some sense of personalized or internalized, you know, insecurity or lesserness because they have some weird picture of what intelligence or success looks like. You know, how many zeros on your paycheck. And for that reason, it's like, I feel so grateful that I am someone who has excelled in whatever areas I have, who's had these opportunities. And I just want to make the most of it. I feel like it's indecent to, I don't want to say indecent because that's a complex philosophical question, but there are so many people I meet who are very intelligent and they've developed a lot of personal success for themselves in terms of their finances or their power or all these kind of malevolent things in life. but they feel like they're justified in receiving it because they're sharp. And the way I always feel like it is, I mean, yeah, you worked hard and you made choices, but you also had a lot of opportunity. I mean, even just being born intelligent or hardworking or curious or creative, like these are things that you could have just as easily not been born that way. So for me, there's a sense where it's like, I do know that there are things I excel at, ways of thinking that come naturally to me. I don't want to take it for my advantage. I want to do something genuine and real with it. The greatest thing that I want to do is just feel like I did the best work I could, the most humble, genuine, dedicated thing that took full advantage of what I'm good at and completely ignored what I'm bad at. Like, yeah.
To make the most net positive possible from your life.
Yeah. And even then, we were disagreeing about what progress means earlier, and your phrase net positive kind of supports my argument in a final Talos. Sorry for killing the moment, but yeah.
Talking about like reading books, maybe just last fun fact before we close this podcast. Any books you like to read?
Yes. I love literature, which might be kind of a stupid answer. But my thing is there is such a fantastic ability to learn about a different time and place in history by just reading what was written then. You know, because it's so hard in history and philosophy to avoid anachronicity, which means taking past events and judging them with present notions. But you can learn so much of the little things, the personal things, the soft details. If you're reading some book about a divorced couple in 1920s France, there are so many amazing ways, even just the ways they interact with like the role of alcohol in culture, what they drink, how they drink it, how do they eat their meals? You know, what does equity look like? What does stocks look like? There are all these small details that you learn because you are hearing a story of someone's experience in life. And the reason I love literature so much is because it's full of those things. I always admire reading, and I think it's important, of course, but I very often see people reading, because they, you know, they want to get something out of it. The same way that you go to the grocery store and you pay money so you know what you're going to get. And they might read books about, you know, how to have power in a negotiating setting, how to learn how to program. And those are very valuable, but I do not want to feel like people are missing out on just the soft, genuine human aspects that they can also learn and take from. So my favorite book of all time might be The Viper's Tangle by Francois Mauriac, which is one of those stories that's just so very much about the complexity of life and about how your ambitions, your insecurities, your uncertainty, your ignorance can just affect your, you know, your life story. That's the biggest one that comes to mind that isn't philosophy.
Any movies you're interested in, or do you not watch movies?
No, I definitely watch movies here and there. I have a soft spot for the James Bonds, not going to lie. The suit in a foreign country might kind of be an example of that. But Beau Travail is a fantastic French movie, but that's more so, you know, cinematography beautiful than necessarily intellectual. But actually, no, my favorite movie of all time, and I wish I was in my apartment because I have a big like canvas of it, is 12 Angry Men. It might have been 1958. It's black and white. It's a story based on a screenplay and a drama by Reginald Rose. And it's about a jury. It is about a jury that is adjudicating on whether or not this teenage Puerto Rican boy stabbed his father. And it's set in, I want to say, New York. 11 of them think he did it. One of them is like, I'm not sure. I don't think he didn't do it. I don't think he did it, but I just don't know. And that's not enough for me to make an answer. And the story is about him attempting to convince the 11 other people to cast out. And it's a fantastic movie and an exemplary example of cinematography. The entire film is set in one room, but the director did such a fantastic job of navigating space and framing to make it not feel claustrophobic, except when he wants it to, which is great. But more so, what I always say is the reason I love this movie so much is because, you know, it's so easy for us to watch movies and feel some sense of envy or admiration for a character. Like, maybe I watch Fight Club and I wish I was as suave as, like, Brad Pitt or something. But, like, sometimes you walk away and you're like, okay, actually, maybe I don't want that. Like, maybe I'm cool with some of the choices I'm making in my life. So it's like your admiration is only short-lived, or your envy is only short-lived. The 12 Angry Men, that character, that juror who is sticking to his beliefs and communicating in such an acceptable and friendly and compelling way to others, is one of those things that I've admired for years, and there's no experience in my life that has made me doubt that idea as something good, worth valuing, and wanting to be like.
Man, talking with you has been a great pleasure. It sort of made me think that everything I've consumed visually, literally, ideologically, as entertainment, books, have been pre-processed, you know, just plastic junk compared to the all-natural, green, farm-grown topics that you really expose yourself to. I don't know if I should keep that in. I'm giving you too much confidence.
But, I think so, yeah.
But bro, it's been so much fun. You're such an interesting person. And you know, maybe next time I'm in America or somewhere, I should come visit. Yeah.
I would love that. Yeah.
Amazing.
All right. Well, thank you for having me on.